Hello, I am Paige Albiniak, editorial director at Promax, and this is the Daily Brief podcast. Today, we are going to listen in on three amazing women talking about the challenges and opportunities they face in today's on-demand multi-platform world. Nickelodeon's Kim Rosenblum, Refinery29's Amy Emmerich, and Gimlet Media's Jennifer Wall all got together in New York City in November to chat with moderator Dan Mannix, CEO of CSM North America, at Promax's first ever Game Changer session, sponsored by CSM Lead Dog. Mannix takes the helm again in our next Game Changer session, taking place February 26th in Los Angeles. He'll be joined by a panel of power players, including Disney ABC's Vicky Free, FX Network's Stephanie Gibbons, and Hasbro's Jenny Whitlock. Check out this first session from November and then register to join us in Los Angeles for the next Game Changers at promaxbda.org.
So when I was asked to introduce this panel, I really wasn't sure what it was about, but first they told me the names. And when I heard the names, I stopped right there because you don't get three more incredible people in the industry than these three. I've had the pleasure of serving with them on the board, having meals with them, going to conferences with them, having dinners, debating, and I promise you, whether you're changing the game or you're game changers, these guys are gonna mix it up. And backstage, we were having a little debate, you know, do we have all the answers in the industry? What are we worried about? And I'm not sure, but I think they do have all the answers tonight. So no pressure on them. But this is a community, at Promax, we're all about building community. We'll be having more of these year round, and we love suggestions and how to do them, but I've heard from a lot of people already here tonight, this is great, more of these, can we please come? So thank you again for hosting, it means a lot to us at Promax, and take it away.
Super, thanks so much. I'll do a little different direction than the puns to start, but so why don't we start off, Kim, with speaking of the changes of the industry. Okay. When you've been around for a long time like Viacom has, you're expected to be a cultural leader. How do you keep up with that generation after generation and with all the dramatically changing times that are going on right now?
I feel like there's maybe a little code in there, like a long time brand like Viacom. You know, the truth is I've been at Viacom over 20 years. I'm working at Nickelodeon in the 90s, did some other brands, came back to Nickelodeon a couple years ago. But I would say that the benefit of experience is actually more important than ever right now, because it's your experience and all of your sort of like, confidence that comes from having done it, having made mistakes, having learned from those mistakes, that allows you to sort of face all the unknown now. So I think maybe the best way to look at having a long career in a changing industry is like the combination of experience and curiosity. Maybe that's like a winning combination, because if you have the benefit of your experience and you can, you know, sort of draw on it, but you're curious and open to possibility and you don't have the answers and you're sort of okay with that uncertainty, I think that's a pretty good combination. So that's true for established brands like Nickelodeon and Kim Rosenblum, established brand too. So
a follow-up to that, and then I'd love to go down the line. So the curiosity part, with the challenges of business and the day-to-day and everybody's working, it's only so many hours, where do you fill the curiosity gap of what's trending, what's next? Where does that come from for you and your job? How do you access that?
I don't think there's any way to fill it. Every day there's like something new and you just keep, consuming and meeting people. Jenny and I just had a meeting not so long ago about Nickelodeon and Gimlet working together. Like, you just keep looking for new partnerships. And I think like this time last year, I don't think I had a clue that we'd be doing, 90% of what we did this past year, I don't think was written down or planned for. So, being open to that, and I think every platform is trying new stuff and you just have to keep like rolling with it. So I don't think there's like a way to stay on top of it. I know people always I don't feel in any way like culturally ahead of the curve. I just want to keep up, and I learn really from my staff too. I have to absorb from them, and I'm not afraid to ask a question like, who is that? Or believe me, if you look at my notes, my follow-up to-do list, a lot of it is names of people or brands I don't know that I'm going to Google when I get back to my desk.
So that, Jenny, she mentioned 90% of new things and tackling. So Gimlet Media, a great new platform that's being disruptive. How do you bring the curiosity and product, and most likely it's probably built from the culture from the start. How do you approach in terms of driving creative ideas and from your previous background to now?
Well, I think podcasting is so new, and so I don't look at it just podcasting. I look at it as audio. The audio journey really is, you know, people spend 5 hours watching television. There's a lot of time where they're not in front of a video, and how do you actually make that experience or carry the brand with you? I talk a lot about like eye to ear, of like how do you carry that into the car? How do you make it an engaging experience? But it's so new that we can just we're coming up with these, like even just brainstorming with Kim, we're just coming up with, nobody's doing really that much except for branded podcasts and their own podcasts. So we're coming up with, hey, can we do a companion podcast, you know, to one of her shows, or for SpongeBob, you know, 20th anniversary, what else could we do to take the audio experience? And then also looking at all the things that's happening in voice. Voice adoption is going faster than the mobile phone, and it'll be in 75% of homes until in 2020. And the amount of times that people use that for, you know, listening to things while they're doing chores or going to bed is just exploding. And so I'm basically saying, think of any time that somebody is not watching a video, how can you help them? And we think of everything like Chompers, which is a toothbrushing app that we made for kids on Alexa. You say start Chompers, and it's 2 minutes. We tell a new story every morning and night to help kids brush their teeth for 2 minutes. We did a companion like game to one of our fiction podcasts to see if I can actually move somebody from a podcast to a skill. So I've told my team, this is a year of learning. Nothing this year is wrong. We're going to keep trying because this is the biggest thing for me, is there's zero data. So I've gone from Hulu, Netflix, to nothing. So I'm like, just try anything, and let's make crazy hypotheses. So I would say I let my team fail and be like, moonshot the shit out of this stuff, you know?
So I love that, and working with a number of media companies over the years, that sounds good in theory, and we're all like, awesome, I wish I had that in my job, where you could fail and fail often. How does that translate to revenue goals and the pressures of advertiser integration, and like, where does that balance come for all of you? Because that's disruptive, it's creative environments, but then where does that other piece come in terms of, you know, business metrics?
That's the innovation part. I feel like I get asked for a new product every single day from the ad sales department, like as if I'm a toy maker and like they're Santa Claus. What new product you got for me today? And the only way you come up with that is through the innovation, which, by the way, is a fancy way to say you're fucking up a lot of things and you're trying and testing. I mean, that is the innovation word. So I feel like you have to tie those to revenue, but you have to have some kind of metric against how much you're willing to spend to test that and what your batting average has to be, which is no different than any other part of the pilot business or test business.
Is there a set formula that any of you have where it's like, oh, we know we're going to fail 70% of the time, and as long as these 30% work, then we're good? Or is it not that formulaic?
I mean, I'll just jump in. It used to be in the old days, it was like you spend 70% on what works, 20% on what you're trying, and then 10% on like moonshots of things. I think that's totally thrown out the window right now, and I think it's become about very small moves. Mm-hmm. So I'm constantly testing. It's like you find something that works, invest in that. Okay, find something that works, invest in that. And so it's really small moves, and I would say that's pretty much like 80% of the job once you get down this bottom of the funnel to figure out what works. And I'll just say for us is revenue, that's the only, obviously the revenue drives everything, but like we are an ad supported business, so we sell branded podcasts, and so we just keep learning on what is working and just continuing to do that better, if you will. And I think it's just the small moves really is really what it's about.
Super.
For me.
And just raise of hands, I'm curious how many people are actively listening to podcasts, and how many would say they're listening more to podcasts than to traditional TV or
and that is not normal. I just want to let you know.
Really?
No, what's not normal is that the data shows only 27% of people actually listen monthly to podcasts. And the research that we did, though, there's 33% of those. So you can double the market if you just actually increase the better user experience. There's 500,000 podcasts. Get people into stuff. And so I'm working with like Spotify's of the world, the Apples of the world, to really help also take my background in Netflix and Hulu to say discoverability, and we really need to work on this because there's an opportunity of just getting 33% more people over the edge to listen. So I think when we're on the coasts, we think we all listen to podcasts, but once you get in the middle of the country and like where I'm from, Iowa, you know, it's like
TV.
Nobody knows what you're talking about. And in fact, I did a research, this is horrible, but like We asked unaided, like, name a podcast company, and only 1% said Gimlet. 99 people, and then 37% couldn't name one, and the highest was 7% at NPR. So we actually have to remember that it's not just New York and LA. We have to get ourselves out into the middle of the country. So.
Interesting.
But that's the game of everything, is discoverability, yes. Right? Everything is about discoverability. So whether you're a brand like Nickelodeon that, you know, has the benefit of a brand, you still have to get, you know, you still have to find your audience and help them discover your content wherever they are. They're not so much coming to us any longer, right? You got to find them, and you got to be discoverable to them.
Yeah.
So, Amy, you mentioned your ad sales team's asking for a new product every day. What? That sounds really fun, for you, and probably challenging a lot of days. What does that look like? What's an example or two you can say of? Here's something we have created that then has been applied, or is it such in development, or?
I mean, the biggest one is the experiential side of the business, which was 4 years ago nothing but a party called 29 Rooms, and now it's a huge part of our business. But I think that's also the market moved forward and how everything is not just an IP of a story, but it's an IP of a world that you have to create around that story, which is what you're going towards, right? How do you expand on that? And for them, it was literally a test that was probably a loss leader when we did the first one, but we realized this was something that's going to grow faster than we could even imagine. I just think the market picks up faster, too, based off that success. So what used to take people 6 years to copy you can be done in 12 months. So how are you consistently iterating off of what it is that you're making? And not only do you have to serve the audience that way, but you have to serve the trade audience that way to make sure that your clients understand why you might be the best at that thing, and not every copycat actually offers the same thing, which is like perception and reality.
So with 29 Rooms, and there'll be, you know, pop-ups is such a overused word, but as an agency, the number of times people have said they want to pop up in the last 6 months is a lot. Like, how do you separate the trends of what other people are doing, and then your boss comes in saying, we need to do this? Like, what's that process look like internally? Is it throwing out for research and development for people? How, to your point, I like that aspect of small adjust. What does that look like in terms of your different environments?
We look at we have a pyramid structure, and it's an audience goal mixed with a revenue goal. So if you can meet and match those through the testing phase, which isn't very far off from television, that's where I started. So it's piloting to series, and how many orders are you going to pick up over time? It's the same idea of how much are you going to invest based off what the ROI looks like as the audience gets bigger, and if there's interest in marketplace rev possibility, and then you grow alongside it.
So something starting one place and going to another. My 9-year-old, which I'm going to try Chomper because he takes forever to brush his teeth, but he had a play date this weekend, so we watched 2 episodes of Homecoming, which was very interesting. I didn't know what to expect, but can you talk about where that started and how that process, what it has become from the origins?
Yeah, we were just talking earlier, is that we got lucked out on this first one out the gate. Well, actually, it's our second one. Our first one failed miserably. But like now the bar is going to be
super high
on regards to podcast to TV adaption. So just for those of you that don't know, Homecoming started on as a podcast, and we did 2 seasons of it with Katherine Keener, Oscar Isaacs, and David Schwimmer. And basically, long story short, we sold that to Amazon as an IP, and it really showed that actually you can generate incredible IP from audio that can translate into television. It's also a great testing ground to say, like, a lot of people loved that, and so it's a lot cheaper than making a pilot. They can say, oh, that works, and there's already an audience for it. And so that premiered all episodes with Julia Roberts and Bobby Cannavale on Friday. And Sam Eshmail, I say his name wrong, but he directed all 10 episodes. That's what Julia wanted. And that came through with CAA and all of that. And it just was really incredible. And what was really incredible to me is the Amazon team was so wonderful to work with, in the sense of they're promoting it a lot for us. And we changed the cover art. We released 4 new episodes on the making of the actual television series you can listen to. We created whole skinned pages, and so it was a really nice collaborative effort between audio and visual. It's amazing, by the way. Like, please listen to the podcast, but also the show is incredible.
So is there anywhere where, if that has huge success now, the next chapter of what that could become, or is that figure it out as you go?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think we're out there with a lot of our IP right now. We've sold 5 of them that are in development, so can't really talk about some of them. Alex Inc. that we did, which is basically based on startup, was horrible. And we learned a lot from that of how to not do a deal where you have no involvement in it. And I think with this one, we had involvement, and we actually worked with attaching Julia to it. And so it was a really get out the gate, we learned. And then we have something with Robert Downey Jr. and Richard Linklater. So that's not in our mind, though, when we're making podcasts. We're not saying we're going to make this into a television show. We are just making really good audio content because we are an audio-first company, hands down. But there's a just beautiful thing that happens when you make great content, is there's and there's so many outlets now.
Right. That's the thing about the small, like, everything that's IP, you know, there's characters and there's, you know, an idea at the center of something. It should be able to live in multiple platforms, you know, long form, short form, like this. There's no, to me, it shouldn't be about like, oh, there's marketing and there's short form content, and then there's, you know, long form or audio or whatever. It's all, everything's content, right? So it's all, everything should jump from place to place. I think every idea can be conceived for another platform, whether it's, you know, jumping as far from a podcast to a, you know, a series. A premiere series, but like everything we do at Nickelodeon, like we take our talent out of the shows and put them on YouTube in, you know, content pieces to build the world. You know, I feel like it's about world, you know, it's world building, and that's what all the platforms allow you to do.
Is there, on that subject, is there some group in the media space or brand that you've caught on to the brand because of that or seen it in different places that then you'd say, wow, I really admire how Casper or how, you know, another show, then how it got launched, you're like so jealous because of how creative they brought it to life? Or?
Well, I'm always jealous of other people's stuff. That's just fundamentally who I am.
Tell your wife.
But, you know, it's interesting you talk about brands. I still think somebody asked me if we were putting Nick Brand on YouTube content versus, you know, non-branded content because maybe it would find an audience, a broader audience. You know, I still believe a brand is an awesome thing for a filter. And you even said you did a test. You would have liked to have more than 1%, right? You would like Gimlet to be a recognized brand, right? Because it helps navigate. It helps people navigate. So, you know, I think we should hold on to the notion that brands are still valuable equity. It doesn't matter, you know, in what platform or, you know, whether it's a linear brand that's been translated somewhere else. So I'm a brand fan, and I'm jealous of everybody, so.
I'm curious, any campaigns that stand out to you?
You mean that crossed over different areas?
Yeah, or just something that creative execution, because I think one of the things, everything doesn't necessarily have to always live in every platform, even though in briefs, you know, everybody wants it to, but when something can work really well, just on Instagram or just on YouTube.
Adidas recently did a game change on sneakers with Billie Jean King. Did you see that?
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty. I just thought the way that they executed that and the way that they hit the influencer network, they really did an affluence and influence marketing campaign, which was pretty impressive in the way that came about. Every little detail, not just the shoe, but the story of the shoe, data drives that came with the shoe, the copywriting was excellent, and just the photography of her was beyond, made you want to wear the shoe, which I think is really the whole point, but it's rare when a sneaker can do that for you.
I mean, my mind
and
is
mission,
just, oh, sorry.
Of course.
Yeah, my mind goes into the Nike, of course, and I don't want to say the obvious, but just the bravery of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think a lot of research we've done is 13 to 17-year-olds are very brand-driven, and they really care about if you have a mission and a brand as well, so there's a huge opportunity there. And then if I'll just do podcasting, because it's so small, but like, you know, I mean, Dr. Death and Dirty John, he does a great, Wondery does an incredible job that's like, we're constantly like fighting with Apple to try to get space in the flow case and such for that he's always taking. And so it's basically, he does an incredible job, I think, selling this kind of salacious things.
Super.
I do think on the back of that, the conscious content, we had to do a huge deep dive. Mm-hmm. I mean, this has been, since I joined Refinery, it was a mission-driven brand. It turned me into an activist and an executive, which I would have never been able to say before that. 4 years ago, that was odd. But today, thank goodness, it's good business. And everyone's now leaning into that you have to have a mission, but the audience is also, the younger audience is now driving a lot of that and steering towards it because they're just, A, they have more tools at their fingertips to know more about what your business is doing and the transparency of it and how you're making the money, who you're working with to make that money, and that matters to them. So it reminds everyone that they have to be a little bit more conscious on how they're doing business in a way that I don't think we did have to be as hyper aware before.
It's interesting, is the Nike campaign, I don't know if you guys Everybody saw with Colin Kaepernick when they came out with it. Initially, the stock of Nike dropped tremendously. And then the marketplace responded, and it really resonated with people and started getting a lot of sales from other people, and the stock quickly went back up. So it is that balance of purpose-driven marketing, social impact, and weaving that in, I think, also for advertisers are looking for that quite a bit. So that's interesting.
It's just a fine line when they walk it.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't just Everybody, do it for the dollar.
Vote tomorrow, by the way.
Oh, yes.
So let's switch gears for a second. We have different people at different stages of their careers in here. Things are changing so rapidly. What, you know, reading the three of their bios was very intimidating getting ready because of all the success they've had. What advice would you have for the audience of how do you make the most impact? How do you, you know, keep having impact in your job? And moving things forward, what career advice would you give to people?
I'll jump in. I mean, I would say my best career advice to myself is be uncomfortable. I've left HBO and started my own company. I worked on the agency side for a long time. Then I went to Netflix prior to House of Cards when everyone said I was stupid. And like now I'm in podcasting and most people are like, what? But I'm doing it. I think learning is really, if I'm not somewhere where I'm learning or doing something I don't really know how to do. Yep. And honestly, the other piece is that I've found, and this might go to the mentor question, but like I've surrounded myself with people that are extremely honest with me, and they are giving me real feedback. And so I've welcomed that. And so even as old as I am now, it's just like I'm constantly like, doing stuff wrong and I like or learning from stuff and I just need to throw and mostly women because this surrounding and saying help me continue. So I would just say be curious, be courageous, and put yourself out there, which feels uncomfortable.
Yeah, and I agree. I mean, I just think you should walk into every project without any idea how it's going to turn out. Because you just don't know. You don't know how it's going to go. I think you have to set goals. You know, I think it's important to ask questions to your boss about, like, what does success look like? What are we trying to accomplish? Right? You need parameters. And then you should work within those parameters to, you know, hit those goals. But how you're going to get there and what it's going to be, like, you just need to walk in wide open rather than come in, like, with a pitch.
Yeah.
I agree with you about like the authenticity. Like, randomly, I was watching Jeff Goldblum on CBS Sunday Morning. And he was talking about, I can't tell if he's acting like Jeff Goldblum or that's just how he is. But he was talking about like, you know, he's just, you know, decided to be authentic and it worked for him. I thought, yeah, you know what? That's exactly right. Like, and if nothing else, like to, you know, people who are maybe trying to figure out their next step or they're starting their career or their next step in their career, is I think you just still have to feel like you have to be comfortable and authentic to yourself. So if you're someplace that you feel like you're putting on airs, you have to pretend that's not right.
I would say one advice that somebody gave me a long time ago was there are no wrong decisions. Yeah. And I thought that was the best piece of advice because, you know, when you're trying to figure out what to do, there is positives and negatives of any decision you make. And if you go into it with your eyes open like that to say, neither one of these is the wrong decision. So.
And that's you need to make decisions,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's just important for people to make a decision.
And you make it when you
quickly.
Only have 60% of the information. That's
farmer's
key.
Math.
So question on that, though, because there's very different cultures of companies. Have you been in environments where that statement would be like, oh, if you operated with no wrong decisions in this company culture, you can get quickly in hot water, or is that?
Well, let me clarify. I don't mean there's no wrong decisions in like business. I'm saying, I mean, there's obviously wrong decisions. Like,
yes.
I've spent $1 million on this. The wrong decision, I'm talking about a career. Like, if you have an opportunity to come up and you don't really know which direction to go, there's going to be something that comes out of it, positive or negative, that's going to help you. So it's more career advice, I would say.
And I agree about your 60% because you're never going to have all the answers. Anybody, if you're ever waiting, like I hate the term like, well, we're evolving. It's or, you know, like, well, once this change, you know, once we get down the other side of this change, it's like, well, that's never going to happen.
Right.
You just got to like live in the unknown, right?
Yep.
You don't know half of what you don't know what you don't know.
But make it fast.
Keep going.
And then pivot.
Manage your expectations is always my big one. If you set them kind of low, then you're only going to aim really high. That's what I tell the younger ones. I do think owning your voice is something that I wish I would have done on much younger, but a part of that is, as someone who started out as a creative, I wish I would have known the game that I was always playing, because I think as much as you want to be yourself and I want to own my voice, don't think for 1 minute everyone is there just for the passion or the mission of something. This is a business game, and any minute you forget that, you're going to lose.
So just building on that, Amy, you're committed to, in your own words, creating a dialogue that matters most to a new generation of powerful women. Can you expand on that and what that means for you, and how
you
hope
say that?
The dialogue of Refinery 29 is going to impact positive change? Or?
Look, I worked in television production, which I didn't realize was even a man's game when I was in it. I had a lot of women who I worked for who are still good mentors to me, like Shillin Evans, and I mean some of the best of the best. But they were one and far few, but I didn't realize it because that's how it was. And then I worked at a place called Vice Media, which I think was like as much as bro culture as you're ever going to get. And then I got to Refinery and was like, I've never seen this many women before in my whole life, and what does that mean for me? And to have women supporting me in a way that they truly felt like, and these are founders of companies, their company, saying, no, 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 we believe you can help us run this company. That is a lot of faith that I just had never felt before. And what they believed was that I can be myself and shave my head and wear whatever the hell I want, and that it was really about what gut instinct I had and this idea of what a feminine leadership principle can be and what partnership really is, which I do think production teaches us, is you're all so important in the execution of something, from the PA to the showrunner. And for some reason, business isn't necessarily run like that. It's always an org chart and who's at the top and who's the one person who gets in trouble, instead of saying like, okay, I get that, but we have to work together. And so the environment allowed for me to believe that. And then we did a big study on just talking to other women, and everybody said, I felt the most powerful when I was empowered by someone else. And I was like, holy shit, this is so depressing. We're not brought up to think, like, I actually have the power, which is the lesson in The Wizard of Oz. It was in you all along. That's what Glenda tells Dorothy, which is amazing. And I'm like, but we're not actually saying that. So as a company, if we think we're servicing people, and you just said that too, is we're providing a resource, I'm not selling them, I'm servicing them, that little nuance just changes what we thought about ourselves and the company, and then more importantly, just tapped into the younger audience is already born and bred differently with more confidence than all of us ever were before. So it's easier to kind of drive that. But it's getting harder in today's world, I think, of just, it's really, some people are afraid of just a female mission, and that feel, you know, they might feel excluded, which is ridiculous, and how do you shape that story? And the intersectionality of it all is, you have to take apart all women and take a look at what that means from a diverse perspective that's inside that, and even as a culture, the language that we use. So, but I'm like in college. You know, you talk to Kim, and like to us, that's a legacy brand, to your point, of experience and knowledge that I have this much of because I was able to walk those halls with so many of those people. But you're running a company with people who, this is their first job. They've never touched that. And you're trying to explain to them why that matters. Don't listen to the trades of like, oh, this brand's hot and this is not. Like, there's an experience level that you need to take into that new thinking. And I think that's kind of the place we're getting to today with all these companies just morphing and merging together is hopefully we'll focus ahead. Sorry.
I won't have a passionate or a smart question on what you just said. I wish I had my notebook because you said some great nuggets. But
that's recorded. So
but I will.
Great.
Hi, Mom. I will build off that because I think a compelling campaign, interesting campaign that you were part of is the That's Me campaign, and people may not know what it's about, but I'd love you to just give a brief description and then talk about how that came about and
sure.
The impact that can have because it kind of touches on some of the same themes.
Yeah, you know, That's Me is a brand campaign that runs on Nickelodeon all the time, and it asks kids to just express who they are, whether they're, you know, whether that's their passion, they're a chef, they're a, you know, cyclist, whether it's their nationality, their religion, you know, whatever it is, and it's sort of about expressing that individuality, and then like really reveling in it and saying like, that's me and that's cool. That's the tagline, because the world right now is so super fragmented, right? We're like living in these, you know, we're just living in these little, in our little bubbles, and we're only getting the information that's being sent to us, right? And that really terrifies me, and I really worry about that. And I think what's really amazing about kids is that they're saying, I live in a very diverse, you know, multifaceted world, and I am myself, and I like who I am, and I like that you're not like me. I like that you're different than me, and that's what we're trying to celebrate with that idea, so you can be an individual and a collective, right? Like, so that's what the genesis of the campaign was. There was also a moment where we were like going along for like the 10th, 20th year in a row doing Black History Month. I was like, you know what? That seems really strange to me. Like, why are we doing these cultural months? And then we have a brand campaign. Like, aren't they the same thing? You know, so we sort of morphed our idea of like doing a Hispanic Heritage Month into an idea of doing a 365 campaign that was just about heritage. So it was sort of a, you know, kind of taking what was a traditional, you know, marketing effort that I think everybody in cable did and sort of reimagining it if you were a kid today. Wouldn't that seem weird for your network to suddenly for 30 days celebrate a particular, you know, heritage? So that was the genesis of it. But, you know, genuinely for me, just from where I'm coming from, I just would love for media companies to be a little more mass, because I think there's some real benefit in like us having mass media, mass touch points. Mm-hmm. Like I was thinking, you know, like Big Bang Theory is going to end this year. Like, that's it. That's going to be the last like big show that we're all going to be able to share and talk about. And I there's something sort of sobering about that. And it concerns me that media is getting so narrow and so fragmented.
You know, it's interesting. We work in the sports space, and there's a lot of emphasis on those big moments like the Super Bowl, uh-huh. and those, you know, live TV moments that are few and far between, the Academies, you know, different things like that. Some great discussion. I'd love to take any questions from the audience of subjects that you'd love to touch on. So, all right.
I like what you said. So maybe this question's for Manny. Like,
there was a mic in the back. Pass it out.
Yeah, you want it.
It's got way more formal now. I can't fuck it up. It's on. Okay, so like content consumption right now could almost be considered a political act. Like it's so divided in our own lanes. And so something you talked about early in this conversation is that idea of the challenge of discoverability and how, you know, yeah, every New Yorker will know what Gimlet Media is, every New Yorker knows what's on WNYC and everything else, but it's not just us. So how are you tackling that? Particularly when it comes to moving outside of just that one audio, like the eye to ear thing, right? Like how are you approaching making discoverability happen when you've got a certain kind of content? And that content is not necessarily political in and of itself. It's more like it's politicized by existing within the framework. Does that make sense?
Maybe. I'm going to try.
Okay.
Answer.
Thanks, I'm sorry.
No, I'll just try to answer that. I mean, there's a couple things I think in there. That one is like, how do we did a big brand study, and we're doing another one in December, and we're actually hired Grand Army to help us with our brand. So I believe also, like Kim, that our brand is important, so we're taking steps to make sure that, you know, we're talking about it a lot and we're getting ourselves out there, associating it with the brand. So that's step one, is just like, how can we, you know, you can still say it's Gimlet Media 100 times in the front and someone's still like, I don't know where it's from. It sort of like reminds me of when I went to Netflix and I went to a focus group and I put this big House of Cards thing with Netflix at the bottom and I said, where does this air? And they're like, FX? And it's just like, people just they're not listening and they're not looking. So it's like, so that's an important thing. We're just the importance of brand I do believe in. And then also talking to people outside of New York and Los Angeles. And then also making shows that are not just about public media. We launched The Cut on Tuesdays, which is it's great. It's a partnership with New York Mag. We are trying to get out of this sort of preciousness of journalism. I have to, like, it's actually kind of hard. It was good that I came in from entertainment because I'm just like, No, there's not many people want to listen to that. You know what I mean? If we want to be mass. So it's also, but it's also like, what does quality mean? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of what we're struggling with internally, is how do you actually have more mass appeal without making, because you say that and someone's like, the Real Housewives of, we're going to end up with a Real Housewives of LA or something, which is, there's a big middle ground there. Mm-hmm. But then the other just big piece, honestly, is until these platforms get better at giving users what they want. You know, like at Netflix, it was, and Hulu, it was 90 seconds you had until, if they couldn't find something they liked, they were gone. It's less, I think, in podcasting. And so, honestly, a lot of my day is wooing Steve Wilson at Apple and Spotify and, like, giving them stuff, like, months out so they want to promote it. And so that's been our biggest vehicle right now is we get on the homepage of these things. Mm-hmm. That literally is what we can do until we get, so it's relationship building, trying to get in front of more people, doing studies just to see what, we did content clusters at Hulu too, of like you looked at the South, you know, you can start to see when you pull up the data, what are people listening to in parts of the country, and then figuring out, we don't have the data like we had at Hulu, where we could say, someone that watches this, watches this, watches this, that lives in Florida. But we can start to look at sort of where things clusters. Are popping and clusters and then start to make better decisions on shows. I don't know if I answered your question, but
yeah, no, that's good.
We don't know. I don't know the answer.
Any other questions?
Hi.
Hi.
So
Atlanta.
Outside of New York.
So you talked a lot about world building and the importance of brands. Are you guys drawing any inspiration from the gaming world? So Red Dead Redemption 2 just opened with 725 million in its opening weekend. Are you kind of inspiring your innovation teams to look at them because they have tons of metrics from their users?
Yes, I was told by my 15-year-old at least 10 times this weekend, that's huge, Red Dead
huge.
I get it, it's huge.
But by the way, they also did a massive marketing campaign. I see the ads in football, you know, like there was a tip-in in magazines. Like, you know, they are disruptors and they are, but they're also traditional marketers, right? So it's an interesting thing. You know, one of the things on gaming is that gets me back into the fragmentation, like that becomes like a niche within I feel like I'm a reverb, like a niche, you know, and I think what's interesting about Red, these big opens is that they're actually community, they're actually broader. And that's interesting to me, like I'm not sure how they managed to pull that off. And of course, you know, like Fortnite this year, like literally, you know, Nick's ratings just, like literally Fortnite open and Nick's ratings just went boom. Like it's just, you know, because, and I don't think it's because the game is so great, I think it's because the community around the game, and I think that's actually, the real secret, and it can TV viewing become a community experience again? That would be, you know.
I have a 9-year-old boy, and without a doubt, the biggest competition for any of the media companies or sports entertainment is gaming. Mm-hmm. I took him to the Nets game last night, and he sat there with his friend the entire time talking about Subnautica. Could barely get him to look at the court. It's a huge, I think, opportunity and challenge of how to reach the younger audience.
I think Amazon does with Twitch is going to be very interesting. Mm-hmm. So we're working with them. The amount of female gamers is on the rise. Unfortunately, most of that in social engagement is very harassing because when you're online and they're all communicating, it's very easy to start taking down the girl gamers against the others. So they're trying to do a lot of work there against bullying. And then we're looking at the community around gaming and what would that look like for shopping. I think a large part of that is obviously revenue, the way market is driving it. But the same way that people watch people game, would you watch people shop? And we have a lot of data that proves they
yes,
will.
They would.
So we're stealing a lot of the gaming over to shopping. And you'll watch them shop in the store as well as just shop online, which is mind-blowing. So I think you'll see a lot of those habits come over. To me, that unfortunately, though, like taps right into exactly what marketing wants to sell women to do, which is shop, which drives me insane. But the product side of gaming is really interesting in how they're letting a lot of creators make the type of game consoles and how personalized you can make that stuff and just a lot of artistic opportunity there. So there's stuff to pull from that for us, at least. I interrupted you.
No, we can take
one. Any other questions?
Italia?
So Dirty John is becoming a series on Bravo. Okay. Yeah, so Bravo's doing that. It's coming out pretty soon.
Okay.
So I think Dr. Death is actually optioned as well. So you're going to see this trend happening, and I think it's either going to go over really well or it's going to be there be too many that are going to suck. So I think we'll just have to keep watching. I think Dirty John's going to be pretty good on Bravo. Yeah.
So I just want to go back to what you guys were talking about mass media and sort of the future of what's mass. And obviously, nobody knows exactly what this is yet, but I'm sort of curious what you guys are seeing out in culture or, like, what sort of indicators you have, like, what kinds of things might be mass again. I hope we haven't given up on mass media, but I'm just curious what you guys see out in the world that might point a direction beyond the Big Bang Theory.
I think the hard part is the business needs to reward the mass, right? And so what's frustrating is, you know, the streamers aren't held to the same business model as people who are ad supported, right? And so I feel like the answer on like what's going to be mass is going to be a little bit about like how's the business, like where's going to be the reward in doing mass? Because I don't understand really how Netflix can keep going and spending and being in the red, and yet their valuation just keeps going up. Like, it just doesn't make any sense to me. So I don't know how we answer that until the business like corrects itself. Because as we continue to get smaller, and the ad and the revenue goes down because it's, you know, it's completely tied. Like, you know, like what's gonna change that trajectory when other people have different rules and they're not accountable to the same business? I don't know.
Anybody else?
I think it's such a loaded question, because what was mass? Mass was forced. There was only three things to watch, and it was forced upon us. And that's what shaped culture, which one would argue is not the right way that we should be shaping culture. So you're going to have to go to a really big niche, and then revenue will drive which one wins from that niche targeting. But that's what the democracy of content consumption is happening now. And I don't know if there's a story that underlines a lot of that. Mass media should be the consumption of voting tomorrow, and how do we get like the stories behind policies, not politics, in a larger scale, and what do we do with news in order to help with that? And I think if that was a better focus, then like, is everyone watching This Is Us? It would be better off.
The
loaded question.
Follow-up, is live the answer? Is live part of the answer?
I don't think live's the answer.
Yeah, I think, I mean, live's been around forever, right? Like, it's not different. And I think, you know, that also just, you know, that's just a moment in time. So if you're an advertiser and you've got to hit a certain number of people in a flight at time, like, that works for you. But I don't think that's really, like, what you're getting at, Amy. Like, it's a value system, right? Yeah. And, like, where's our collective value system, and how does media reflect that?
Yeah. And live has to go across all platforms for that to work, right? So maybe the conglomerations, as we see all of this, folding on top of each other, and AT&T decides to just say, on every single thing that I own, this live program is going to get shown, because they're limiting what else you have access to.
I mean, I think that's the biggest question in the mass, is like, what's happening with AT&T, what's happening with Disney, and then, I mean, just, one of the questions might be, what keeps you up at night, and that's like, well, all my friends that work at all those places, because it's going to become, like, it's going to become so bureaucratic. And I'm scared to death of what's really going to happen there, because they're going to be the masses now. It's going to be, again, we're going to have like four companies.
I think one thing is also same or different audience or different place for the same mass. Like Popularmos, one of the YouTube channels my son watches, has more streams than the top-rated primetime shows from 10 years ago. Yep. So it's just a different format and a different place. And I don't know how he's first finding it from the community. I'm always curious, where'd you know, get exposed to this? But it's just different places, I think, in some cases. But
yes.
So speaking of some of those things, if you had to say one trend that you're looking at for 19 that you think is either exciting or that keeps you up at night, what would you say, Kim?
Well, Amy brought up live stream. I think live streaming is really interesting. And I think I've said the word Twitch like 10 times in the last 5 days, you know, and one of the issues for us is that, you know, we can't share our content as generously as we would like because of the agreements we have with our partners, you know, with the people who pay us for our content. So I think that the idea, and the reason live stream is just interesting to me, is that's that community building and giving people content around community and going to them where they're at rather than making them come to us. So I think that's really exciting and interesting and will be really disruptive. And I'm not sure how, you know, people in like, they have a business model like we do. I don't know how that's going to adjust, but it's going to have to, because I think that's the way it's going to go.
I mean, I'm going to have to go into the audio space just because that's what we're looking at for next year. But I'm really bullish on smart speakers. And I believe that you can do a world of good with them versus just the, I mean, I know they're really creepy. But like, I think you can do, like you can help people, whether that's the toothbrushing or like, I love what Ethan is doing over at Aptiv in regards to like, I don't know if you guys know that fitness app for 15 bucks a month, but it's basically a trainer in your pocket. And he totally does not use video, it's all audio. And so I do think there the space on smart speakers, not necessarily just podcasting, audio strategy mm-hmm. is going to be where we're looking at most things next year, is not just a podcast, but like if a brand comes to us, like McDonald's, we're doing a skill for McDonald's, but like actually saying, okay, branded podcasts may not be the answer and ads may not be the answer. Let me see if I can, where am I finding these people in audio to help your, keep them engaged with your brand longer. So understanding their TV buys, understanding other things so we can complement that, whether that's with complementary programming or a skill or voice in some general. So voice is where we're putting a lot of effort.
Which I think it all falls under direct to consumer. Like to me, that's the three hot words now. Mm-hmm. Everyone wants direct to consumer, which normally means ticketing or events or subscription, and what that will all mean no matter what way you're telling your story. So I think that's a big one.
This may be a loaded question, but you think about valuations, like I'm a big Peloton fan. Speaking of
John
audio.
John Paul is fabulous.
Is there like a hot space or trend that you're like, I wouldn't bet on it. I'd hold or sell related to a trend or a type of company or innovation that you've seen that you're personally not.
Facebook. No, I'm not a big one on social media these days. So I would say that's a trend. I'm staying a little. I have no money to spend, so I shouldn't even be talking about this. But I feel like that is shining star is going away. And I think exercise actually is and wellness is a huge. Yeah. If you look at just what Headspace does,
yeah.
and you look what Stella did with Stella Space in the Headspace, there's just a lot of brands coming in and actually owning the kind of the wellness side of it. I mean, I meditate while you drink beer. I don't really know, but it worked. So I think wellness and health is.
Yeah, I heard the founder of Headspace talk this week, and he talked about his MBA partnership. And I guess one other question: the dream partnership for your brands that you'd say, "Oh my, we'd love to partner with X," that would be game changing for 19.
Media.
Let's
say
do it,
later
Jenny.
Down.
Let's do it.
Just kidding. All right, we'll take.
Let's do it.
Anybody else on that? Or?
No, I mean I'm a big Peloton fan, so I think John Foley's done an incredible job there. They're
amazing.
Now getting into like hotels and so we're trying to figure out how do we get into gyms and how do we get into cars. I'm talking with Buick.
Yeah.
You know, because that's what's happening now is you need to make this kind of like seamless. Between people's entertainment and mm-hmm. follow them where they are because mm-hmm. they're not always in front of a screen these days. So, yeah.
Super. Okay, so closing thoughts. I'm not doing great time management here, but
we'll take one more question.
I was going to say, what are you most proud of? Something that you've worked on that you said, I'm most proud of X. What would you say, Kim?
Well, I would say the last couple years at Nickelodeon, and there's a couple of people here from Nickelodeon, I think collectively, we have really evolved Nick to be a 360 brand. You know, not so long ago, Nick was not sure, you know, Viacom was suing YouTube. Nick wasn't sure that kids were on social media because it's a 13 plus platform and it's hard to be, you know, how do you be there and still be true to your, you know, brand and be safe and all those things. And I'd say now when you look at, you know, our team, which has got an interactive group, we've got a digital studio, we've got an amazing YouTube channel, we've got an incredible Instagram following, and I think we've done all of it while still being an awesome kids first brand.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm most
that's
proud
great.
Of.
Jane.
Mine's an easy one. Mine's The Handmaid's Tale. So what I'm most proud of doing that at Hulu was that we were going to market it a particular way, and working with Margaret Atwood, and you know, and then the election happened, and we spent about a week like crying, but then at the same point, like, how the hell are we going to market this? That's actually going to become a reality. We were going to market it as if like that this is like will never happen, and so and then taking really bold chances. Like, I mean, I had a man say to me in December, like, everyone's telling me The Handmaid's Tale is so relevant, and I don't understand why. And I'm like, first of all, don't ever say that again. but I really realized that, like, the power of this, and I got to do a lot of talks about human rights and feminism, working with Margaret Atwood, and like I really feel like at the time the gays were getting persecuted in Chechnya, like it was really a platform and. You know, to either talk about it, but let the show talk about it. And I think we made a conscious effort to put the women in the red robes at South by Southwest and not the Women's March because we didn't want to politicize take advantage of a political movement. What we wanted to do is let the show speak for itself. And so there's certain things I'm super proud of, and that is that I got a line in the Super Bowl spot that said, Ralph Fiennes says, we only wanted to make the world better. And she says, Offred says, better. And he says, better never means better for everyone. And I got that line in that I was like so proud of, and just also getting these women walking around. And also we had a poster outside that said, the future's a fucking nightmare. And I got that through. I don't know how. So I just like, it was one of those like bold, I was like, I'm That's going awesome. For this. I'm fucking going for it because I'm mad. And so I'm most proud of that and the
That's
change
awesome.
I think has happened.
Love that. All right, it's going to be tough to top, but try.
I can't top that. I mean, one, I'm just proudest of the whole team at Refinery, because we're like a little engine that could, and I couldn't have even imagined in 4 years we did everything that we did and barely standing. But we did Shatterbox Anthology, which is the film program that we did. We've now are in third season, but basically 4% female directors. Now the story is everywhere. I feel like we had a tiny part in that 4 years ago, building that out, thinking, playing against the bias that, well, you're a female digital company, you have no business in the film space. And when I talk about partnership, I think I owe Sundance a great deal of debt, believing in us very early on that we can change the perception of the world when we change who is behind the camera to tell the story. So Shatterbox is my probably biggest.
That's awesome. Well, I thank you.
No more questions.
You're all
thank you.
Amazing.
Thanks.
And enjoy the discussion.
Thanks.
Paige Albiniak is editorial director of Promax. Andres Trujillo, Promax's social media and community manager, edited this podcast. Video Helper provides the music. Digital content producers Kate LaCaire-Marion and Kayla Marie Hardaway contribute to Daily Brief. Although Promax is rebranding to Promax only, our social handles remain the same for now, so you can find us at PromaxBDA on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You can also always reach out to us at dailybrief@promax.org, and you can subscribe to the Daily Brief podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.